Welcome to Hub Dialogues, a podcast that celebrates the big thinkers and bold ideas that are driving the public conversation. On Hub Dialogues, you'll hear the Hub's editor-at-large, Sean Spear, in conversation with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers about the issues and ideas that they're passionate about and that they think we should spend more time focusing on. The Hub's podcasts are generously supported by listeners like you. Visit thehub.ca to enroll now as a free member. Members get access to the Hub's best content and analysis, including original news reporting, commentary, and yes, lots more podcasting. Visit now, www.thehub.ca.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Harrison Lohman, managing editor at The Hub. I'll be covering for Sean today. I'm very pleased to be joined by General Romeo Dallaire. He's a global human rights advocate pushing for an end to mass atrocities and the use of child soldiers. He's also a former Canadian senator, but here's what he's most known for. 30 years ago, General Dallaire served as force commander of the United Nations Assistance Mission for Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. He's here to talk about his new book, Peace, A Warrior's Journey, which traces why human beings have come to blows, fighting in bloody wars against one another. He also tries to forge a path to peace. We talk about the Rwandan genocide, war, Canada's shrinking role on the world stage, the conflict in the Middle East, whether peacekeeping and the international human rights movement has failed, and whether he is too optimistic about the younger generation's ability to bring about that sustained, lasting peace. We taped our interview on Friday, April 12th. Thanks so much for joining us, General Dallaire, and congratulations on the book. I read it cover to cover.
My God, you must be the first guy to do this.
So let's just move to more somber subjects here. A few days ago, obviously, we passed the 30th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. And 30 years is a long time. It's almost my entire life as a young man. I'm only 32 years old. You were there, and I'm wondering how clear the memories of that genocide are still for you, you know, three decades after the fact.
It is, you know, that's a very pertinent question, because when people go through what can be exceptionally trauma scenarios that are not only traumatic, that can leave injuries like PTSD, but even deeper ones like moral injuries, where you see things that go fundamentally against everything that you believe in and so on, it stays digitally clear and you relive them in slow motion. And so depending on what triggers it, this could happen at any time. In fact, one of my, on this weekend, we had the 10 lasting Canadian veterans who had, Canada had sent me. I'd asked for 1,000. They sent me 10, 12, in fact. And one of them committed suicide 15 years later. And so you do not, with time, lose the clearness. And even at times, if you wake up in the morning, you smell and feel for nanoseconds where you are. And this, the people of the Holocaust, 75 years later, still live that.
One thing I think you can speak to better than almost any Canadian is experiencing evil and helplessness in its purest forms. You will never explain it to a level that will have people understand what that feels like to its full extent. But what is it like to witness evil to the extent you did and to experience that level of helplessness to the extent you did when it came to your inability to respond to the evil?
Well, the first shocks are the most powerful. My first ambush, the first scenes of slaughter, the first scenes of the injured in our the hospital where they are mutilated left and see, the first scenes of women having their fetuses extracted from their body and left dying, those first occasions, they are the most powerful. Because after that, what happens is that you trigger into, what am I doing here? What can I do? What am I supposed to do? And so your whole sense of reason for being present takes over. And so it's not as if you see it with a veil. You see it with a certain, it's sort of like a teleprompter. As you're doing things to try to solve this, try to attenuate it, try to meet the needs, and working day and night to save people, to pull them out of dangerous scenarios of negotiating and everything else that goes on, the veil prevents you from the same initial shock, but it's always there. And so after about a couple of weeks, I was noticing that some of my guys that were with me were starting to lose their sense of focus, of orientation. We're always under a constant sense of urgency that was beyond what was required at the moment. And so I did two things. One, I worked them day and night until they fell asleep, until they dropped, so that they didn't have time to think, because you don't want to give them time to think. You want them to concentrate on the mission, on what they can do, and not on to think and review the things. That's the first thing. The second thing is I would evacuate people for maybe 24 hours and give them in a safe place in the headquarters where they could sleep and feel safe and have a bit of food and wash a bit and so on, and just sort of pull them out of the exercise. That gave them a break, that gave them a chance to realign themselves with reality of what they had to do and what was going on.
I'll leave this subject in a moment, but I just wanted to touch on one more thing I read in your book that really kind of troubled me and scared me in a way. You say that humans have this idea that we share an innate reluctance to kill one another. You say that it is actually false, that through enough coercion, someone can be convinced to kill their neighbor. How can this happen?
It has to be injected like a drug into you. The natural instinct is not to kill. But if you are indoctrinated to all of a sudden not see the human being anymore, but literally see the cockroach, if you are pushed to a level of rage that blinds you from any sense of balance in your own consciousness, if in fact you are caught up in a scenario that you truly believe it is your personal security that's at risk, then you will take action. And so that's the first ingredient that's necessary. And that's what they did. They indoctrinated the militias to kill with machetes, treating the Tutsis as cockroaches. And they were firmly, firmly engaged in that. Others was by outright hate instilled by the political sort of scenario that was presented, that the Tutsis were there to actually abuse them and to destroy them. Some people were even indoctrinated to believe that the Tutsis had tails and horns, and they were like the devil, and they ate babies. So you shift all the references that you have sitting there into a whole different gear. However, once you've killed, then you enter another stage, because once you've done it once, the second time, it's just a repetition. It's not a new experience. It's a repetition. It's a continuum. And then as you go along, you become more and more indoctrinated into the application of what had been instilled in you, that this is not really a human being. And so, yeah, you got to get rid of them.
Have you heard this from people who have done this? This is what they've sort of described to you as what was going on in their minds.
The militiamen themselves, and they were teenagers. Yeah, absolutely.
I want to pull the lens back and talk about Canada. There's a large discussion going on about our place in the world and what that looks like. And I know time has changed, but riddle me this. In 1992, this is around the time I was born, again, around 30 years ago, Canada had 3,285 peacekeepers in the field. Today, it's approximately 57. We recently deployed in Mali, and I was speaking to a veteran journalist who was there, and he said that Canadian soldiers there were asking him what things looked like beyond the fence, because they were not allowed to leave the base. He had left the base because he'd gone on a mission to report on German and Dutch soldiers beyond the wire. Is this poor showing of peacekeeping numbers? Is it the result of the practice no longer really working as it once did on the world stage? As I mentioned, is this a world problem or is this a Canada problem?
And it will go a bit farther than that, than CNN history here. During the Cold War, Peacekeeping was a rich country's business. There was only about a dozen countries in the world that actually were able to afford sending troops, sustaining troops in the field, and they were doing it in missions called Chapter 6 missions, which meant is that you were not there to fight, you were not there to take sides, you were not there to stop fighting. You were there because the fighting had stopped, both sides had signed a peace agreement, and both sides wanted to implement it, but they needed a referee without a red card. So we sent a piss pot of people and lots of people. And Yugoslavia and Rwanda in the new era, that is the post-Cold War era, were the first ones where all of a sudden, wait a minute, the game has changed. Now it's no more just watching, as I was caught up in doing with my mandate, and originally the same thing with the Yugoslavian, but we had to actually, we had to protect people. We had to engage. We had to stop people. We had to use force if necessary. That had not entered into the equation yet in the early 90s. It's only after Rwanda and Yugoslavia that we started to realize that these old Chapter 6 missions of observing made no damn sense, particularly in imploding nations and failing states where it's Rwandans killing Rwandans, it's Yugoslavians killing Yugoslavia, and so on. It worked between states, but it didn't work internal to states. And so as the missions got more demanding and risky, the nations that used to send them were less and less inclined to take casualties. And the high point of that was Bill Clinton pulling out of Mogadishu and the Rangers in 93, October 93, pulling out. And so he set the stage for nations not to take casualties in humanitarian missions. And so everybody else just followed that. However, developing countries, you know, countries like Bangladesh and even old countries like Pakistan and so on, African countries, South American countries, well, they were prepared to send troops because the money was good also for their country. And it gave some sort of experience to their troops. And so we abdicated out of peacekeeping and handed it over to the developing countries who don't have the equipment, the training, the capacity to plan, and the ability to sustain logistically these missions. And that's why so many missions have been stalling and never ending and never finding true solutions. Because even when with the Chapter 7 authority, they just didn't have the capacity to conduct the operations.
I think I've heard you say when it comes to the West, there's a need to sort of step up and, you know, it sounds coarse, but pay the price in blood. You need in these humanitarian missions to be willing to put Western soldiers on the ground with the chance that they might lose their lives and, you know, in the effort to, using the name of your book, achieve some sort of peace.
There was a very strong debate in the Canadian military amongst the generals. On one side, you had generals that said that the old priority of a commander was the mission first, your people second, you know, prepare them and get them ready to do it, and yourself third, you being able to conduct it. However, what entered the equation was, if we're doing a mission that is not involving the security of the nation, but we're doing a humanitarian mission, then it's not the mission that's first. It is the protection of your soldiers that's first. So you put your people first, then the mission, then yourself. And in doing that, well, you don't take risks. In doing that, you can't handle casualties. And so your example earlier on of this buddy that, you know, you got Canadians inside the wire and you got NGO civilians with nothing running around outside the wire. Well, that's because the government can't handle casualties in uniform. The NGOs don't answer to the government. And so the hypocrisy of this, it goes beyond any logic, absolutely any logic, and has created enormous amount of ethical and moral dilemmas within the military as to their role and what they can do and what they should be doing. And so, yes, I am of firm belief that mission is always first. And in so doing, whether you're doing it for a humanitarian reason, to help humanity, to advance human rights, to protect civilians innocent, or whether you're doing it because you're fighting the border of your own country that's being attacked directly, it's the mission first. What lost also got lost in it, and I wrote on that, on the will to intervene when I was as a senior fellow at the Montreal Institute of Genocide Studies, where the concept of responsibility to protect came out in 2005, which Canada led, which said, and the whole General Assembly accepted, that if there are people being massively abused in their own country, we have the responsibilities of the rest of the world to go in and protect them. Well, what happened is that there was no will by the political elites to want to apply it because it had enormous risks of casualties. And so Bill Clinton, through his presidential directive 25 that said the United States will not go in unless it's in its self-interest. Self-interest was the first point. And the second point is we don't want casualties in these operations. And that has permitted countries to just stay out. And countries that need the money, countries that are willing to take the risks, which are many of the developing countries, because there's something to gain for them in that, they're the ones that we're putting in as cannon fodder to the new concept of peacekeeping.
The new concept. I just want to stick on Canada for one more second here. I think another thing you've said is Canada is not Canada beyond its borders. I think this relates to it's our reputation, right? Can you tell us concisely sort of what that means? Given your travels, I'm sure you go all over the world, so you get a sense of, from the outside looking in, we're constantly talking about ourselves from the inside looking out, but from the outside looking in, what does our international reputation look like today?
Our international reputation, I'll sum up, it comes, let me say how we use it in French, because it's a magnificent, it's in Québécois really, a term, and it's grand parleur, petit faiseur, big talker, little doer. And so, yeah, we talk a good game, but we really do not inject our commitment. We don't inject the statesmanship. We don't inject the diplomatic intellect and innovative ideas and the perseverance to sustain the efforts to try to solve problems. We do not inject the security forces that might be required and able to sustain that in missions where you want to stabilize in order to permit the processes to go on and protect people. We have taken those very deliberate decisions. Yeah, we went into Afghanistan. Well, the world went into Afghanistan. So the big boys went in, so we went in. Yeah, we're now in Europe. Why? Because NATO and Europeans are caught up now again in a Cold War with Russia. And so, of course, we'll go back and do that. But talk to them about going into the Congo. Talk to them about going into Myanmar. Talk to them about going in to assist Colombia with its stabilization.
What about Gaza?
Nobody's got the balls to go to Gaza. Mm. Nobody. And furthermore, Gaza, nobody really talks about peace. All they're hoping for is to establish maybe a situation of a certain truce. Because what they've done is, yeah, they might be trying to wipe out the fighters of Hamas and so on. And yeah, they're conducting operations that are against law of armed conflict, human rights, crimes against humanity, massive abuses of human beings. They are going against all the parameters that we've established internationally over the years in trying to achieve the destruction of Hamas. What they've really done is they might stop the ability of Hamas to do something now. But what they've instilled in the youth of Hamas, in the youth of the Palestinians, and in the youth of the world, because now the young people are seeing in real time a genocide going on. And what do you think that's going to leave for them? What it's going to leave is a generational war, because they're not going to forget it. And many of them, their schools are shot. Their jobs are gone. They won't be able to marry. They won't be able to make money. They won't be able to live decently. And so those factors are going to come and they're going to really bite us on the butt, because they ultimately will become the next generation of whatever organization that will come out with a big lip on to go and continue the war. So we have, over the years, not found a way to find lasting peace anywhere. What we've done is found ways to establish truces that we hope will hold without going to the core of the frictions between the people and try to resolve them there. And so when I see people talk about peace, it's got to be people who want to go into the entrails of the problem and with enormous amount of effort and insight and patience and ability to negotiate and to discuss and to help change the cultural framework that exists there to attenuate the rage and, in fact, help people from the bottom up, not from the top down, from the bottom up want peace. And none of that is going on.
You say we confuse peace with the absence of war. And I note that, and I'm sure you face this, I'm sure you get a lot of criticism because there are a lot of people that would disagree with you as phrasing it as a genocide, right?
They don't know what they're talking about.
You would just say that they're wrong.
They don't have a clue what they're talking about. But what is more important, however, is that whether you do call it the genocide or not, the international community is not intervening. Okay? It's not even following the rules of genocide. It didn't do it in Rwanda, and it's not doing it in Gaza. So calling it a genocide will be helpful afterwards if you want to prosecute some assholes, fine. But calling it a genocide now has zero effect in the engagement of the international community to really want to stop what's going on.
Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Maybe you've seen in this very same podcast feed a new program called Hub Headlines. It features the best analysis and thinking of our writers each and every morning. It's delivered to you in a convenient audio format in this podcast feed. All you have to do is click and download. And instead of reading Sean Spear, Howard Englund, Ginny Roth, any one of the terrific writers contributing to the Hub each daily, you can listen to them on the go. It's convenient. It's built for people like you with busy lives. If you're multitasking, if you enjoy the Hub but can't get on a screen, check out Hub Headlines. We've got you covered with the audio version of the Hub's best commentary and analysis each day. Again, you can grab this all on the same podcast feed that you are listening to this program now. Simply download each morning Hub Headlines and enjoy our best analysis and insights.
I want to read a quote just talking about the UN. And this is from a few years ago, I will say, but I read this and I kept it for many years because I thought it'd be interesting to potentially ask you or someone who worked at the UN about it. This is from a former United Nations Assistant Secretary General for Field Support. His name is Anthony Banbury. He's a 30-year UN vet. And he wrote a piece in the New York Times called "I Love the UN, But It Is Failing." He says, "I was unprepared for the blur of Orwellian admonitions and Carolonian logic that governed the place. If you locked a team of evil geniuses in a laboratory, you could not design a bureaucracy so maddeningly complex, requiring so much effort, but in the end, incapable of delivering the intended result. The system is a black hole into which disappear countless tax dollars and human aspirations, never to be seen again." Is he being fair there, or is he just totally off the mark?
No, he's not off the mark, but he's not complete. First thing is, the UN, and in fact, peacekeeping, is about $7 billion a year. Hey, that's not even the budget of Toronto. Yet it's trying to cover all of the world with peace. So the first thing is, the UN is not an expensive endeavor. And the UN, however, suffers from the inability to generate funds to be able to meet the challenges that we like to throw at them, because the big powers and many in the world are quite happy to see the UN ineffective. They're not necessarily keen on having another player on the block that could fiddle with what their strategic ambitions are. So the big players have not really pushed. There was an exception, and this is where it comes important, where I come back to the article. Kofi Annan gets, he's an old UN hand, right? He came up through the ranks in the UN, becomes Secretary General, supported a lot by the Americans. And then it's time for a second mandate, and the Americans push very hard that he becomes, he gets a second mandate. But they put there and supported by the others, not necessarily the Russian Chinese, but they never objected, that Kofi Annan find and articulate the reforms that are needed for the UN to become effective. That everything from the construct of the Security Council to how you recruit people, how you train them, what are the parameters of the involvement of the UN, not only in peacekeeping, but in the whole world of UNICEF and all its agencies, UNDP, you know, and MONUSCO and everything else. And in that, establish the format of framework of funding that can meet the requirement and also adjust the Security Council. Well, guess what? Months before the about nearly 100 recommendations that Kofi Annan had built to do the reform, it gets vetoed. He can't present it to the General Assembly because one member of the Security Council vetoed it. And guess who that was? This guy has a white mustache. He even became National Security Advisor to Trump. His name is Bolton. He was the ambassador, and he's the one who kiboshed all those reforms. So the only one that got through was responsibility to protect, which nobody wants to use because they're scared it's going to get them embroiled in things that they don't really want to get into. And so, yeah, it needs reform. Yeah, it's got to be brought up to speed. Yeah, the whole concept of how it recruits, how it trains, how it employs, its concept of administration. I thought working in Canada with the Canadian government was tough. It's nothing compared to what it is in the UN. And so those things require enormous amount of reform and need a representation of the world in doing that. Remember, it's covering the globe, not covering one country. It's covering the globe. And so at the budget it's calling now, and what we try to throw at it because we don't want to do it, it's peanuts compared to the money we're pissing around and doing all kinds of other things that, like, as an example, the Americans massively modernizing their whole nuclear arsenal. The most useless weapon system in the world, and is an affront to our human right to security, is the existence of nuclear weapons. And the logic of it I got this from millennials and Z in high school, in fact, one case very, very blatantly. This kid said, why are we worried about a little oil spill here in a plastic bag when there's still nuclear weapons that can wipe out the whole of humanity? And I said, well, there's even worse than that. I said, we're putting peanuts into trying to pick up the plastic bags and the oil spills, but we're spending hundreds of billions in modernizing the nuclear weapons.
I wanted to ask you about human rights. We look at the UN again. We look at international cooperation. After World War II, we get the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Since then, we've seen regimes continue to oppress their people in the millions. When there's lecturing about human rights, it's regularly from the lips of Westerners, right? Telling countries in the global South about their perceived abuses. I would add as well the term human rights, which I at least thought it exclusively encompassed fundamental rights like the right to a fair trial, the right for me not to be tortured, now includes things like the right to internet. And some wonder if it's been diluted by adding those labels to the definition. I'm just wondering overall if you think the modern international human rights movement is facing major challenges or whether it's failed in some way.
I think that the whole human right precept of its existence, and that's my cuckoo clock, so I don't, that doesn't bother. The whole precept of human rights is the fundamental agreement that all humans are human and that not one human is more human than the other, which essentially says you respect, not tolerate, everybody. We have some differences and nuances, that can create frictions, but fundamentally we're equal. That's the premise of human rights. And that is not a Western invention. That is humanity. That is intrinsic in the human being. We've articulated it in various ways, but that fundamental premise exists. Now, people will say that it's a Western invention and so on because we see its application through democratic processes that seem to be easier to apply, through a rule of law that are in states where there is, where countries that have a history of stable and reasonable governments can actually apply them. But at the same time, we have countries that have been led by dictators. We have still autocrats. We still have bodies that believe that there are some people who are less human than others, so they can still be treated. By the by, the colonial powers instilled that enormously. I mean, the genocide in Rwanda was started by the colonial powers that created the separation of the ethnic groups and created all those frictions, supported by the Catholic Church, by the way. So those countries, funny enough, we've supported them. On the one hand, we believe in the human rights, but on the other hand, we bought off a whole bunch of these dictators during the Cold War to keep control under people. And many of those countries were so artificially created that they were a basket case to start with. And so only by a heavy hand and abuse of human rights, abuse of law, of fairness, and so on, could these guys keep a grip. And so we nurtured that. And then all of a sudden the Cold War ends. We don't need these dictators anymore. And now we're sort of crapping on them for not becoming more democratic faster. Well, democracy, we're still fiddling with. Look at the junk that's happening in the States. And that's a democratic state. And so, of course, we're going to continue through a transitional phase of trying to shift many of those nations that have not seen anything else to try to even understand what democracy is, try to understand what rule of law is, and try ultimately to see how governance is responsible to the people and the use of force is responsible to the people, and that ultimately human rights is the guide. So it's an evolving sort of scenario that I believe that the younger generations will be far more attuned to. And we're seeing it in the young generations in African countries and so on, their intolerance to the old guard and so on. We're also going to see it a lot more with the revolution that the women are going to create, because the day of the male-dominated, ego, macho, paternalistic structures that all our institutions have been built on is going to realize it can't solve these complex problems unless women are totally integrated into that process. And that day is when we will see a shift significantly in the whole philosophy of leadership, philosophy of governance, philosophy of institutions, and ultimately philosophy of advancing human rights.
Just a few more questions for you. You talked about R2P and you talked about big countries pushing back against it. And you talk about in your book, in a lot of newspaper coverage here in Canada, there's a ton of condemnation as it relates to China and Russia. You write about how they followed a different path rather than the democratic capitalist world powers. Are you trying to put forward the point that we make them too much of the boogeyman in world affairs? What were you getting at when you sort of described them that way?
There's not just one solution to the evolution of humanity. The question is how do you make all these different concepts based on the cultural framework and the background and so on, how do you make them well together and integrate into a humanity level sort of construct? Because ultimately, it is only when humanity feels safe, when all of humanity, to which we can Skype now, so we can actually talk about that happening, when humanity feels that it is living in true peace, lasting peace, that's when humanity will be at its ultimate of being able to go beyond itself. We're just holding ourselves back because we're spending a lot of money beating the living daylights out of each other and using very close-term tactical requirements, economic and so on, and advantages and the use of power to establish peace and security. All those things are going to be attrited by the younger generations that don't believe in that and see, in fact, the power they have through the communications instruments that are still immature, but they're evolving, and their belief in humanity and being global. They're going to see it through the planet and the communion between the planet and humanity in order to not survive, but to thrive. And the overarching one will be the presence of women as equal and reconstituting the fundamental premises of our concept of peace and security in the world.
Mm. Important, though, to distinguish between said oppressive regime and the people that are sort of under their thumb, right? And not painting them all with one brush, right? It's fair to say that these countries are run by authoritarian regimes that are holding their populations hostage in many ways, given how they're governing.
Don't forget, it's not just the guy on top or the person on top. I mean, that type of philosophy makes its way all the way down into the local community. So power that is given to people to be able to oppress and to impose without any sort of calling of the use of that power is, in fact, the most injurious instrument to prevent the human beings from being able to achieve their full potential and push people to, establish an atmosphere of rage because of the frictions that they have locally that are played upon by the more senior people. And so it's a perverse instrument that starts from the top and makes its way down. And so it's got to be fought from the bottom up. We got to stop that. And guys don't have the ability to do it because the hubris, the egos, and the misogyny of the males simply can't get into the real essence of what is the friction between the people. And women and men together, they can pull it off.
There's kind of a revolutionary sort of zeal near the end of the book that you're playing on right now, right? You talk about, you think you phrase a gestation period of activism that can be pushed towards revolutionary levels to find some sort of peace. Are you calling for some sort of revolution here? Is this what you're asking for?
Is it taking you that long to realize that?
But what does that look like? When you say things like this, it scares a lot of people or has them scratching their heads as to what that actually looks like on the ground.
A revolution is not a bunch of people running around shooting up the goddamn place. This revolution is a time where there is so much energy, so much innovative thinking, so much reforms, not changes, reforms, because there's change, reform, and then revolution. So many reforms accumulate together and so many influences that see opportunities to make things better. Unless you push that envelope, what you got is people fiddling with the status quo. So they're fiddling on the edges. And that's what our governments do. They feel smug in this sort of atmosphere of security that they think they've created, only hoping to hell that something doesn't pop up and create a problem. And so that's why I say even after World War II, we didn't have peace after World War II. We had a truce because the next day we ended up facing the Warsaw Pact. So we ended up in a Cold War. No, it is only when people realize that the shifts need significant engagement by different players into a different construct. And that will happen. The women, one side, but the young generations, they're onto this. The young generations are going to become activists like we've never been because they can communicate easily. They can coalesce easily. They're going to start realizing that even in democracies, they hold the balance of power and they're educated enough now to be able to manage it and to push it. And so the generations above them are going to get pushed aside because they're too slow and also because they just don't want to change.
the young people you interact with, you actually find them to be engaged and interested and knowledgeable about the world around them?
I see them in the universities, in the schools. And yes, I see a globalism in their eyes. They see the globe. They understand climate, the new climate we're in, as a global problem. They see human rights as a humanity problem, not as a local municipal. So they are generations without borders. They're going to mature that. It's going to take decades, but it's going to mature and it's going to pick up momentum. And remember, the younger generations are integrating women already far, far more than we ever did. And in so doing, they're coming out with already some fundamental shifts in how the workplace, the family, the environment in which they want to live in and want to grow in is different than the ones I was used to, and probably yourself, although I'm not too sure if you're probably a millennial, you're under 35, so you're part of that, you're the top end of that revolution.
You're trying to recruit me, General Dallaire.
Like it or not, you're part of it.
Okay. I just want to finish up on this, because it's one thing to create peace, which is so hard to achieve, as you've described, if we've ever really achieved it in the first place. It's another thing to have sustained and lasting peace. We talked about Rwanda off the top of the interview 30 years ago. It's also been 25, just over 25 years since the Good Friday Agreement in the UK, which brought an end to, I think, something like three decades of horrible conflict in Northern Ireland, families ripped apart, terrorism, death, destruction. And yet that peace seems to have held. And I'm wondering what you would say are the conditions that allow for real lasting peace to not just be reached, but be sustained and fed.
You really think that peace is there? You go to Northern Ireland. The barbed wire is still there. The walls between the different communities, they're still there. The reaction when you talk religion is still there. The idea of intermarriage still has frictions. Hey, we're in Canada, and 250 years ago, the French and the Brits beat up each other. Have we solved truly an equal and completely transparent equality between the French and the English in this country? Why is Quebec so active and so activist? And why often do we get a negative reaction? This is this country. So that's not peace. That's when I joined the army. My dad, who had been a soldier and did World War II and was a soldier in the 20s, I mean, a career soldier, he said, "Romeo, if you want to get promoted in the military, change your name from Dallaire to Dallards, because you're going to go nowhere." That's in 1964. So no, the frictions that are there are just sitting there, still annoying for us to have lasting peace. And so I would argue that it's going to take new angles to be able to bring this stuff together. And those angles are simply not in the construct of the institutions that we've built. And on the contrary, these institutions that we built often create divisions, like the nation states and nationalism and so on, religious differences that are massively separational and so on, the economic side of the house, of course, with its influence. So a lot of that is still in existence, and that is evolving. The question is, where does it go? How does it brought together? And so I believe that there is new think out there coming in to play, and that the hypocrisy of what we play with is not going to be tolerated in the future anymore. You don't spend $1 trillion on modernizing nuclear weapons and maybe $1 billion on climate change. That makes absolutely no sense at all. And the young people are picking up on it.
And so in your mind, we don't have an example yet to point to. It's not good enough that people aren't killing each other. You would say there's no example to point to in terms of someone that's achieved lasting, real peace?
Oh, because there's no statesmanship. There's no there's very little desire to take risks. There's no humility in the communications from all levels. And because of that, and because self-interest dominates them, the Montreal, the Globe and Mail article tomorrow to survive in political spheres, that the politicians have not been able to rise to a higher plane that needs that higher plane thinking to be able to mesh the complexity and the ambiguity of the era in which the whole of the world is at risk, both the planet and the whole of humanity. And by the by, now we can see the whole damn planet, and now we can talk to the whole of humanity. So what are you going to do about it?
All right. Well, that's a good question to end on there. Thank you so much for giving us your time. I really appreciate it. It's a fascinating book. I suggest that Hub readers give it a read as well. And thank you very much, General Dallaire.
Good questions, and all the best to you. And keep that smile. That's what's important.
Okay. I'll try.
All right, then.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Hub Dialogues, brought to you by Hub Canada Media. Visit www.thehub.ca for daily analysis and insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation. Thehub.ca gives you access to our original news reporting and the thinking of the Hub's best writers, including Sean Spear. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you will receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was, along with all kinds of other terrific benefits. The host of today's program was Sean Spear, the Hub's editor-at-large. This episode was produced by Amal Atter-Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.